Thank you very much. And hello, everyone. I'm Dan Kay, and I'm a sexaholic. I'll be reading from a script I prepared. This is to make it easier for the interpreters. I will also be pausing after each phrase to give the interpreters an opportunity to translate. So I think the first thing I'll say is to remind you that this will be my opinion, my story. I do not speak for SA. These are my opinions. So let's see. I better slow down. I forgot that I have interpreters already. I've been asked to share my experience, strength, and hope, including the role my father, Roy K., played in both my addiction and recovery. It's been a bumpy road for both of us. Thanks to our addiction and character defects. I'm sure many of us have experienced the same thing with our families. Of course, our conflicts and issues were not the real problem. We just didn't see it at the time. We were caught in the grip of the blame game, looking outward to fix the other instead of looking inward to work on ourselves. We tried to clean up each other's yard instead of cleaning up our own. I found it impossible to change myself without practicing the principles found in SA, such as forgiveness and accepting others as they are. I regret that my father and I could not achieve this until he was dying of cancer. That was September of 2009. It was in his last moments that the veil was parted and we saw past ourselves to each other. Our hearts were joined in complete forgiveness and reconciliation. Thank God. How sad it would have been if he had passed without that. My addiction started long before I ever experienced lust or sex. It started with pain and trauma that would later need relief by medicating with lust and a couple other addictions. This began in my preschool age. Dad was deep in his sexaholism. He was absent most of the time, chasing the big fix, as he calls it in the white book. When he was home, he was emotionally unavailable. He was seldom engaged with the family unless it was to rage at us when we disturbed him. Events like that sent me into self-protective ways of living. They were survival tactics in order to cope with life. And this is where my addiction started. I needed a happy place where I could retreat and hide. I became a daydreamer. Fantasies were my escape, and compulsive eating soothed the fear. Later, science fiction books took me out of this world and into other worlds. In an early prepubescent age, I discovered masturbation. It became compulsive immediately. The addiction blossomed. It had a narcotic effect that lasted long after the act. It became my drug of choice. It was better than food and fantasy. But of course, I hung on to those as well. By this time, I was a sexaholic in fourth grade. When I entered puberty and discovered girls, the fantasizing became romantic and erotic. This was rocket fuel for my disease. I was too shy to talk to girls, but I sure could fantasize about them. Having it all in my head kept me trapped, unable to learn how to relate to girls. Fear held me back, and I made sure fear got medicated. I believed I was physically ugly. I believed I was defective and undesirable. Decades later, I found out this was not true. I was terrified of rejection. The need to medicate went very deep. I know now that Dad never wanted to be abusive. He was not a mean person. He was not physically abusive. He was tender-hearted. He loved us. But it was terribly confusing to experience love and rage in the same house. His disease made him irrational, reactive. And my disease did the same to me. And with my family, thankfully to a lesser degree, thanks to how he got into recovery and changed. Once as a child, he raged at me for a small infraction. But he was devastated afterward. He wept with sorrow as he tried to comfort me. I experienced the same thing, similar things, with my kids. Anyway, my erotic fantasies progressed to stealing girly magazines from the corner store, then on to pornographic movies and videos, then marriage. Like many of us, I thought having a moral outlet for my sexuality would solve the problem. It did not. Then came repeated discoveries by my wife. There was hurt, anger, and betrayal. She thought she'd married someone else. She didn't know my real self was in hiding and keeping secrets like cyber sex and flirting and trying to connect for the intrigue, the tease, and the forbidden. Trust went out the window. I was unable to stop looking at other women in front of her. Wow, it hurts to remember how much I hurt her in that and many other ways. I'm so grateful I don't have to do that with my precious current wife, my second wife, and now my life partner in recovery. She too is in recovery. Other programs, including Essanon. I tried many times to stop, but could not. I looked to my religious beliefs to heal me. I tried therapy and self-help books, but learned helplessness had me looking to be fixed by outside means, not realizing that this was magical thinking. I learned many useful things then that I find helpful today. But knowledge and beliefs aren't enough for my addictions. At the time, I didn't realize it would take losing to win. I didn't realize that I would have to have a part to play and that I would have to become willing to get into action and to change my ways of living. By this time, my dad had gotten sexually sober and into recovery. There was no sex addiction program in town at that time. He joined AA in order to treat his sexaholism. He did this for a number of years. It was in Alcoholics Anonymous that he learned the principles of 12-step recovery that were to become the foundation of Sexaholics Anonymous. He began to make amends to the family, but he was too new to do it smoothly. We were alienated in the process. We had our role in that, of course. He tried to 12-step me to carry the message of SA, even though I wasn't ready. I did learn from this, and I didn't have to make the same mistake with my family. When I got sober, though I've made plenty of other mistakes with my family, sad to say. Recovery is a long, slow process. But I did learn that before an amends, I write it out and run it by my sponsor. I believed Roy's sobriety definition was based on his Christian beliefs. He was a seminary graduate and had been a pastor, a minister at a local church. He left the ministry so he could act out free of constraint. One time he brought a prostitute home and introduced her to the family. Isn't that just like a sexaholic? I think he was trying to help her, but it felt very strange. I didn't know that she was a prostitute until years later. Did he meet her acting out? I don't know. Sexaholics can do crazy, chaotic things. After a number of years of sobriety, he admitted to having a religious addiction and never rejoined a church. I went through that as well. But now I know that SA's sobriety definition is based on the reality of our condition, learned the hard way from hard experience. Morality is not the issue when addiction is in control of behaviors. To paraphrase the White Book, we have taken ourselves out of the whole context of right or wrong. As my disease progressed over the years, and the consequences of the illness, my illness, became so painful, I became more open to Dad's efforts to reach me. I took his advice and joined AA like he did. I abstained from acting out sexually for 5 years before relapsing. I was still lusting. I didn't understand that lust is the first drink. I probably did not want to understand. I know I did not want to understand. I was focused on not acting out while holding on to lust. I was in denial like any good sexaholic. I was like the alcoholic who is determined not to drink the whole bottle while believing one shot would not be a problem. Years later, after I began surrendering lust on a daily basis, on a moment-by-moment basis sometimes, much to my surprise, I found that I did not have the urge to look at porn, masturbate, or act out sexually anymore. I don't know that's true for everyone. But when there's no first drink, I'm not triggered into drinking more, so to speak. During my first 5 years in AA, I was abstinent, but not sober. Mentally, emotionally, I was still crazy, still reactive, emotionally intoxicated with conflicts and fears. I couldn't even feel emotions. I was full of resentment and anger. Of course, I relapsed. After some time passed, I tried again. I got another 5 years of abstinence before relapsing. Lust, still hiding. By then, other sex addiction programs were coming online. I got another 5 years of abstinence in one of them. But it was the abstinence of defining my own sobriety. And that did not include lust. I relapsed for the third time. The recovery I began in the mid-1980s did not bring me to an admission of powerlessness over lust or the willingness to surrender until 8.5 years ago, when I finally joined Sexaholics Anonymous. 5 years after my dad passed away. I have not had the urge to act out since March 25th, 2014, when I began drawing the line at lust. I wish my dad lived to see me in Sexaholics Anonymous. It would blow his mind to see me here today. The son that fought him at every turn. The son that told him I did not want what he had. After all, there's nothing wrong with masturbation. I don't mean that literally for the translators. Each time I started one of those 5 years of abstinence in the past, I felt like I'd hit bottom. I was sure I hit bottom. It felt like it. But now I see that it was motivation by dire consequences, by horrible consequences. I was still trying to control my disease by using a program instead of letting the program use me. I decided what actions I would take or not take based on what I felt like doing or not doing. I believe we call that half measures. They got me nowhere. It was like getting a spot. Some of the things, for example, getting a sponsor and not using the sponsor. Starting the steps, but stopping in step 4. On and on. I was trying to get away with doing as little as possible instead of making the program a way of life and doing whatever it takes to stay sober, going to any lengths. It was a Dan-directed program, not a higher power. It was not a higher power-directed program. Today, I have the evidence that I've hit bottom. I let the program use me. If it wants me to stand on my head, so to speak, I stand on my head. If the White Book calls for a period of mutual celibacy in my marriage so I can heal from lust, so be it. Program actions can be hard. I'm an addict. I don't do hardship. I run from it. I resist it. Or I medicate it until I quit fighting and become willing to go through hardship and suffering without using. This is when the pain of remaining stuck is worse than the pain of moving forward. Nothing changes if nothing changes. I get what I pay for. Today, I call or text before acting out instead of after acting out. And I use all the tools of the program continually in the steps, multiple service positions in SA, as well as my food and drug addiction programs, sponsorship, on and on. No more half measures. I know what my minimum requirement for program involvement is, and I protect that. I build my life around that instead of trying to squeeze a little bit of program into my life. I'm going to have to... I won't be able to finish all of this. Okay. My second marriage is unbelievably wonderful now that it's not polluted with lust. My wife knows she's safe. She trusts me. Thanks in part to our periods of celibacy, lust is out of the marriage bed. There's a quality of love, camaraderie, intimacy, and physical union that I did not know was a possibility. Far more satisfying than my lust-fueled life. I understand that this is not a promise for SA members. I have other hardships that I have to endure. I have other suffering I have to endure. Maybe another member, maybe their hardship is loneliness, not having a life partner. But life is hard, fellow sexaholics. I've learned to accept life on life's terms. I've learned to accept hardship, to learn and grow from it, rather than to whine about it and suffer needlessly. It's up to my higher power to grant me a blessing on one hand and adversity on the other. And it's different than yours. So I talk about an amazing marriage. That's my blessing. I may, if I have time, touch on my other adversities. I believe that fear and self-deification have been at the root of my unwillingness and resistance. After all, if I surrender and God doesn't do it, it won't get done. So I better keep trying. Besides, I might not be able to do things I want to do, and I might not be able to do the things I do want to do if I step down from my throne and hand my crown to my higher power. How did I break out of self-will and a Dan-directed program? I had to experience the consequences. I had to come face to face with the underlying fear, such as the day my desperation, in my desperation, I prayed and gave God permission to do whatever it took to bring me to my knees and surrender. I thought something terrible would happen, but I was desperate and said that prayer anyway. I was afraid God would break my spirit and pound me into the ground with horrible consequences, so I would never do it again. So I'd be broken and compliant. Just like a punitive parent. Instead, I was soon brought to the edge of the abyss and shown my end. In horror, I saw where I was headed. It was after I'd relapsed the third time. I'd recently remarried and stopped going to meetings. The lust became stronger and more frequent. I tried to control it, on again, off again. Demoralization set in, but I resisted going back to recovery. I knew that the other S program wouldn't work for me, and I was afraid I might have to go to SA and admit my dad was right. I knew instinctively that I'd have to give up lust. Darn. I stalled and it got worse and worse. The time came when I finally realized I was about to completely give in and fall into full-blown sexual addiction. It would devastate my wife who married me, thinking I was done with sex addiction. I would lose another marriage. I was about to be sucked back into the abyss. It was a moment of absolute clarity. I felt like I was hit with a bucket of ice water. I was in shock. In this awakened state, I felt the scary horror, the frightening horror of this terrible disease. I knew I'd have to go to SA, but I had yet to make the decision. The next day, my wife approached me. She was tense, but not controlling. She asked if I'd thought about going back to meetings. I was relieved. I was ready. I'd given God permission to do whatever it takes, and that's how he did it. Some of us do experience horrible consequences. But I do not believe it's like the punishment of an angry human parent. It's God's way of motivating us. Born of his intense love and desire for us. And it's worth every drop of blood we have to pay. The freedoms and joys of recovery are simply not available otherwise. About surrendering lust hits. I talked about surrendering to the program. When the lust hits come during the day, that's something else entirely. When I finally became willing to surrender lust, no one needed to tell me to make surrender calls or text other members. In the first 2 years, there were days I'd make 3 to 5 calls. I've known what to do. It's simple to pray for the person who's triggering lust. It's obvious when I need to call my sponsor. It's simple, but not easy. The disease always pushes back. This is my story. It's not everyone's story. In my food addiction program, surrender came in stages because my unwillingness was so strong. I need to wrap it up here. Fighting lust is a losing battle. It's like getting in the ring with a heavyweight boxer. He knocks me out every time. But now I have a big brother who will step in the ring for me and knock that guy out. However, Big Brother will not do it unless I go to the gym every day, for me, every morning, and work out as if I'm the one going in the ring. I have to do my part in the gym of the program and daily minimum requirements. It's like my dad used to say, without God, I can't. Without me, God won't. Am I getting close to time?
Yes, Dan, you're quite past it.
I'm quite past it. Okay. then I shall stop. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you. Thank you for helping me stay sober.